Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Peter.
Episode 139, recorded on October 13th, 2021. Back to the future with Google Distributed Cloud. Good evening, Ryan, Jonathan, and Peter.
Hey there.
Hello.
Well, glad to see you guys made it back. Ryan and Jonathan and I missed you last week because we did the show by ourselves, which was good because we had so much content that if you'd been here, it would have been like 3 hours long. So it was fine. Actually, I think it worked out for all of our listeners. They appreciate you did not make it. But you missed out on me congratulating you as I'm getting a show out. I have yet to listen to the full thing. So the first half was great, though. So that's what I know so far. But I'll get to the rest of it later.
I think it only got better. I really think we hit our stride at that point.
Yeah. And the lightning round was awesome.
Jonathan and I had an awesome lightning round last week by ourselves. It was great. It was so good that we gave each other each a point.
So. Oh, cheaters.
Hey, when you're not there, the rules are whatever we decide the rules are.
When he's here, the rules are whatever he wants. Yeah. So we're just following by his...
We're just following Peter. All right. Well, it's a busy week because Google Cloud Next started yesterday and day two was today with some awkward live keynotes. I don't know if you watched either of the recordings, but man, I was like, have you guys not done live before? Because, you know, the first part, the recorded video, because I didn't watch it live because I didn't have time for that. But I watched it that evening and, you know, first you had to fast forward through the hour of, you know, the show's going to start in an hour, you know, in any minute now message that they put up, you know, an hour before the show actually started. They didn't think to flip that off before they posted the recording. And then you know, awkward mic checks and things were in it. And then, you know, just sort of awkward and some really bad jokes too. You know, the CEO of Alphabet was there, who I'm spacing out his name at this minute. But, you know, he says, you know, it's how you can't be here because, you know, TK doesn't laugh at my container jokes or something. Like, it was super awkward, super, super weird. So worth watching just for the posterity's sake of it. But I'm pretty sure that's going to be in person. Please. But, you know, Amazon, you know, took a book out of the playbook of Google and Azure and didn't announce a whole lot last week. You know, because of Google Cloud Next, which is good. So we have only a few stories for them. So let's start there. First up is Fraud Detector, which Amazon Fraud Detector for Google is off the charts right now. But we'll get to that in a little bit. First up is that they are now supporting event data sets. The new capabilities enables customers to easily send and store their production fraud data directly within Amazon Fraud Detector. And customers could even use their event data sets to train ML models with higher predictive performance since the models can apply historical context to new events by automatically calculating values such as account age and purchase frequency. Prior to this, you had to do the terrible thing of storing it in S3. Just too much work, I know. Not only are they giving you the event data sets this week, it's inside. Fraud Detector in S3. Yeah. They're also lowering the price of Amazon Fraud Detector ML with the new fraud predictions. Previously, if you were using the fraud detector, and this is a little weird verbiage I had to look into. They're adjusting the usage tiers and that use fraud detectors online or fraud site insights ML models that you reach the highest discount level sooner. Previously, you needed 400,000 fraud detections per month to reach the 50% discount mark and 1.2 million per month to reach the 75% discount. Now, when I see predictions, you mean I'd have a positive prediction that this is fraud? Like, you know, 400,000 is a lot. 1.2 million frauds in a month is a lot for any credit card processor, I imagine. So I'm pretty sure they're all pleased that now you can get to the 75% level at only 100,000 predictions, which will save you about 56% over the previous pricing at that volume. So that's a lot of fraud. I guess maybe Amex and Visa and MasterCard, who would be the ones who buy this feature, really want this. But man, that's a lot of fraud detected.
That's such a huge issue. Such a huge issue that affects everything. I'm super excited to see the world get better at this.
Does seem sort of funny to me, though, like the just the way the discounts work. It's like if you have, you know, like it's encouraging people to have high fraud in order to get a better price. Like, is that how that works?
Yeah, right. Exactly. It seems like an anti-pattern to me. I'm like, wait.
I mean, you could look at it the other way.
Are you sure it's not positive and negative?
It could just be that.
Like, we predict that this isn't fraud.
Counts. Well, it could just be like you really need this. I'll give you a break on the price.
On the other hand, Amazon make money every time fraud happens. I don't know. It's like,
well, I mean, they make fraud. They make money all the fraud that happens in their store all the time with all the fake goods that are being sold, I guess. So,
yeah. So, I mean, I kind of see why they would want to manage this through the service itself and not through random S3 buckets, because all it would take is somebody to accidentally misconfigure an S3 bucket and upload a whole ton of customer historical data or something and expose that publicly. I mean, that would just be horrendous. And so bringing it in as part of the service and having Amazon manage the security around that is probably a lot better of a position.
Yeah, for sure.
Agreed. Well, I think when we last talked about console mobile apps, we went on a whole diatribe looking at what Azure and Google and AWS had. And I think I actually complained specifically that the AWS console mobile application was missing ECS. I think I specifically mentioned this thing.
You did.
So I'm pleased to announce that they have added ECS support to the AWS console mobile application. I will take full credit for this because I vented about it on the show. And clearly someone in the product management team must have heard me talk about this because they've added it, which is great. And then I actually went to go use it. And that's where it fell down. So ECS is there, and I have clusters, and I see my cluster. And so it starts out with the CloudPod cluster, because our website runs on ECS. We'll champion up there. And I have 7 services, because I have other websites that are running this too. And it says my resource utilization is 740.59% CPU and 685.48% memory. That does not help me on the road. I don't I assume that that's because I've allocated more CPU than I'm using. But not clear from this first click. And then, you go into the second thing and you see cluster overview and you see services and you see tasks. And when you go into those tasks, it does a list of the GUIDs, which does not help me in any way, shape, or form. The services is fine. It gives me where I want to go. And I can adjust, I can stop services and edit the number of running tasks, which is really what I wanted out of it. So it does do the one thing I needed. It's just there's a couple extra hoops that I think are necessary to actually get me where I want to go.
I suspect the metrics are actually just due to a quirk of how ECS comprises their utilization metrics, which has to do with the overall available sort of resources of the cluster, as well as the container definitions that you put. So,
yeah. So if I knew that was the upper calculation minus my committed provision capacity, and that was what was left, then I'd be like, fine. But I can't infer that data from what the screen says in the mobile app, which is the sin of bad mobile app design, is when you can't tell what something is unless you have, you go read the documentation.
Well, it's not great in the desktop either, in my opinion. Yeah,
I was about to say that. I was like, it's not great in the console either, to be perfectly fair, or in the CLI. So I'm going to let it go. But, but yeah, thanks. Thank you, Amazon. I appreciate it.
So who's the console app used for? I mean, aimed at? Is it just so that companies can disturb their staff on vacation and people can actually, SRE teams can actually modify running services from the beach or the boat while they're fishing or something?
You definitely can't do a lot of modifications. But so I have used this feature a couple of times, when I've been away from home and I got an alert that the website was down and I'm like, well, I'm just going to bounce the tasks. Well, though I couldn't bounce the tasks, I had to bounce the whole EC2 box. And so then I just bounce a box and it auto scale out and be fine. So now I can bounce a task. It's really an incident management capability if I'm on the go or I'm on call and I can do something quickly. But yeah, or I'm on the beach. So if you're on call and you're assigned on call, you shouldn't be at the beach anyways. You should be somewhere at least reasonable distance to your internet, Wi-Fi, and a laptop.
Maybe you just try to sneak out and go to Game 5 of the Giants Dodgers playoff series.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's true. Maybe that's what I'm doing. Or, I thought I could run to the grocery store, which is the number one excuse I've ever gotten for why the on-call person is not available during an incident. Is at the grocery store. So I've learned that grocery store trips are the key way to have an outage for you at any time.
Or code for something else.
It could be. I don't know.
At the grocery store, and there's only one checkout open again.
Again. Such a terrible situation. Yes.
Wait for the RCA. Yeah, I'm sorry it took us so long. Safeway only had one checkout open.
And the self-checkout, I was buying alcohol, so the self-checkout wouldn't work. All right. Well, moving on to the CDK 8S or CDK Kubernetes, or I don't even know what this is.
CDK?
But anyways, the CDK 8S. Project is now generally available and now supports the Go programming language, which is apparently the number one requested language, which I was like, that's an interesting choice. And then I saw what they support already, which was Java, Python, and TypeScript. And so, I would take Golang too. So, I mean, Python's not bad, but if my other two choices were Java or TypeScript, I'm definitely wanting Golang. This, of course, is a CNCF sandbox project, and it's an open source framework for defining Kubernetes applications using a general purpose programming language. And the output of the CDK, program is Kubernetes YAML that you can apply directly to any cluster. There's 3 main components, including the CDKS CLI, the core, and the plus. The CLI, of course, is your command line tool for doing all your initializing and synthesizing of your CDK 8S project. The core library defines the building blocks and is something you probably shouldn't mess with unless you know what you're doing. And the CDK Plus is a simplified intent-based API for interacting with your Kubernetes resource. And if I like the CDK, I would use this.
What could possibly go wrong?
Abstraction on top of abstraction? Nothing.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to get Photoshop out now and turn this into like a pill bottle or something, because when you say the output of the CDK 8S program can be applied to any cluster, it's like, it just sounds like a medical thing of some kind. Applied directly to the cluster.
Well, even when I was CDK 8S, it sounds like some weird, you know, CDK. It's like, oh, that's some weird drug for something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess it'd be kind of cool, though, to think about developing an actual GUI for your company's specific use case around deploying apps.
Well, even that really wouldn't work, because it's all it's doing is spitting out config files that you still have to then, using, you know, the Kubernetes API, enact. So it's a little
Well, but I mean, I would assume you would also have the app do that on your behalf.
Yeah, I assume the CLI has the ability to do the kubelet commands, right? Like, or at least invoke it.
Not in the write-up. It made me very suspicious.
Just dropped a bash.
I didn't get that far in my research of this particular story. So
it
I apologize.
Really looked like it's for like the init setup for your project. That's what the CLI is for. Yeah.
Nice. So it's and then synthesizing your output. So it's like, it's good for probably the CI/CD pipeline of how you get to a file you can actually apply. And Golang now.
Everyone loves data-driven apps, though, so I'm just looking forward to seeing the config file that drives the CDK 8S thing that generates the other config file. I mean,
have you ever seen HTML generated by Microsoft Office?
Yes.
It looks similar.
Oh,
yes,
it's so good.
I've not seen that, and I think I'm going to avoid that from now on.
It's so good.
It's kind of like my Hello World thing, actually. I always laugh at how big just like a printf Hello World can actually compile to in different languages. I did it in Golang the other day. It was like 2 meg. Like 2 meg for a print Hello World.
Did you compare your code to the Hello World repository where they have a Hello World example code for every language on Earth?
No, I did not.
It's a pretty good GitHub repo. It has actually like, here's the hello statement for every language, and it's there. And so you can go see how you did.
That's funny. But yeah, the Microsoft Word, anything in Microsoft Word rendering as HTML is just so enormous. And like, back in the 90s and early 2000s, when everyone had like dial-up modems, it was just totally impractical to use.
I mean, if it's 2 megs for the Go, what is the Java jar file for Hello World? It's got to be at least 10 megs, right?
I don't know. I mean, I probably think that would be smaller because you know, most, because that's just bytecode, and then all the actual bit that does the work is in the runtime. So
That's true. But I see in the case of Java, you already have the runtime, and then you're just giving the bytecode. But in Go, you're actually giving the full binary. So yeah,
the full thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Homework for next week.
If you took PHP code and you use that Facebook thing that takes PHP code and converts it to a binary object, maybe that would get to 2 meg. I don't know. Like, we have work to do.
I mean, it should literally, like, ideally, it should be like a few bytes, 100 bytes.
A few, you'd hope.
Right? You know, we're going to have to edit all this out, right?
All right.
Yeah.
No, this is staying for sure. Absolutely staying. No doubt about it. All right. Well, if you have been a big fan of AWS Backup, and you know, perhaps you've asked someone like Jonathan to write that up for you in CloudFormation, which, you know, the problem with CloudFormation, of course, when you mess up and you need to delete the stack, you now deleted your backup. So to avoid that mistake from Jonathan's CloudFormation code, Amazon Backup is announcing the availability of AWS Backup Vault Lock. This new feature enhances customers' ability to protect backups from inadvertent or malicious actions, and it helps customers implement safeguards that ensure they are storing their backups using a write-once, read-many worm model. So there you go.
Amazon likes to call that the write once, pay forever model.
Yes. That's also how you could describe it.
Yeah, I'm going to get in the worm business for sure.
You know who really loved the worm business was EMC, who's have a worm SAN, and then you would fill it up and then you could not get the data back if you messed up your prayer, you know, your policies. So then you got to buy another SAN. It was great.
Do you think the only way to get rid of the worm data is with ivermectin?
Okay, we're gonna move right along to GCP. We're gonna get off that train of thought. All right, so Google Cloud Next, of course, is this week. We already talked about that a couple times, but before Google Cloud Next, they announced the artifact registry for language packages is now generally available, because no one wants to talk about artifacts during any keynote. And so using a centralized private repository to host your internal code as a package not only enables code reuse, but also simplifies and secures your existing software delivery pipeline. And by using the same formats and tools as you would an open source ecosystem, you can leverage the same advantages, simplify your build, and keep your business logic and application secure. And as of today, support for language repositories in the registry is generally available, including Java packages, Node.js for NPM, and Python packages for PyPy. In addition, they are now supporting Linux distributions in preview, support for Debian and RPM packages. Using the Artifact Registry also allows you to take additional steps to improve the security of your software delivery pipeline, including container analysis, access to, via VPCs, monitor your repository with cloud audit logs, and use the bin auth attestation builder with Cloud Build to create attestations that binary authorization verifies before allowing container deployments, as well as IAM for repository access control. I'm surprised there's no mention of NuGet or any support for .NET. So apparently Google still believes those don't exist, or Chocolaty, yeah. And there's a couple other languages that are still missing here as well. So I suspect those will come out sometime in the next, you know, 6 to 12 months. We'll talk about it here on the show when they come out.
That's pretty cool, though. I had to jerry-rig this with scripts and open source software and S3. Mm-hmm. This looks clean.
Yeah, and anything that I've run doesn't have the additional features of you know, the secure signing or, you know, validation, which is, you know, has become a big issue now.
So I miss what are they actually announcing? Because I know Artifact Registry was GA.
Well, so before it only supported container. It only supported containers. Now it supports the packages from the different three languages. That's new.
Really? It's taken a long time to do that.
It has. But here we are. They have it now. It's all that matters. unless you need .NET, then you're still screwed. So, all right. Well, let's get to Google Cloud Next, day one. This is a long one, and I've broken it up around what it is, so we can talk about each part of it individually, because I think it's a lot to unpack. So Google says now more than ever, organizations are looking to accelerate their cloud adoption with easier development, faster innovation, and efficient scale, all while simultaneously reducing their technology risk. However, they admit that some workloads can't move to the public cloud entirely or right away due to factors such as industry or region-specific compliance and data sovereignty rules, which needs low latency or local data processing requirements, or because they need indeed run close to other services. To ensure these workloads can still take advantage of what the cloud has to offer, Google is announcing the Google Distributed Cloud, which is a portfolio of solutions consisting of hardware and software that extends their infrastructure to the edge and into your data center. And depending on your organizational need, you can run Google Distributed Cloud across multiple locations, including the Google Network Edge, the Operator Edge, like in the 5G LTE space, the Customer Edge, or the Customer Data Center. Of course, this is all built on top of Anthos, and is an open source-based platform that unifies the management of infrastructure and applications across enterprise, on-premise, edge, and multiple public clouds, all while offering you consistent operations at scales. And using the Google Distributed Cloud, or GDC, customers can migrate or modernize applications and process data locally with Google Cloud services, including databases, machine learning, data analytics, and container management. And at launch, it'll support partners such as Cisco, Dell, HP, and NetApp. So that's the beginning where we start, which is basically saying, you know, you can run the Google Cloud on your own hardware, which I guess is sort of what Azure does and provides to you with Azure Edge, as well as some of the other Azure capabilities, and sort of what you get with Outpost, but without the hardware requirement that hardware has to come from Google. So that's kind of our beginning place. So that's the first one. What do you think of that?
The first thing that confuses me a little bit is that if it's built on Anthos and Anthos can already support bare metal, why do we even need, I guess there's going to be tighter integration with those vendors, but it seems like it's sort of already available.
Well, and so this is, you know, where I think they get you is that they're supporting databases, they're supporting, you know, other Google services on top of this hardware, which Anthos is just Kubernetes today. And so that's where I really wanted to go see some deep dive videos and breakout sessions after the keynote. And this is the one area that there just was no content as of Tuesday. So I'm hoping that, you know, as Google Cloud Next continues over the next week, that this will be something I can update you guys on next week. But yes, I agree with you. If it's just Kubernetes, you already had that with Anthos. So really, you're getting the next generation of that, I think, which is you're getting Anthos, plus you're getting the ability to run Google services natively in your on-premise world.
The thing I liked most about it, though, is that you didn't need connectivity to a Google data center, unlike AWS with Outpost.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't need to pay for a huge data pipe to the nearest region if you actually want to deploy this in the Arctic, for example, or the Antarctic, as the case may be.
Or Mars.
Or Mars, yeah.
I mean, it is kind of crazy because it's an open source project that's basically, you know, how to run, you know, Google Cloud in your own data center, right? Like, and that's a giant risk to take. It's probably a smart risk because I do believe it's going to end up where workloads will just eventually end up on Google Cloud and be built for it. But
I mean, I never saw anybody running to run Azure in their data center, though. I mean, other than like big, massive companies like Accenture and those guys who are already partners of Microsoft already. But, you know, I haven't seen a lot of customers running that way for Azure. So I don't know what the demand is for this capability. You know, again, how many customers have adopted Outposts is a question as well. So I assume it's you have to have it, and the fact that it's built on top of Anthos probably makes it easier for them to deliver this capability without having to do a huge amount of investment.
Yeah,
presumably the open source piece is just the framework for how to deliver services, but it isn't actually the services being delivered.
That'd be my assumption too. But then why are you contributing to it as an open source project? Like, thank you, I'll give Google, this $1 billion company, all my free labor to make their thing better, to run their services. Yeah, it's great. All right. So then the next part of this is the Google Distributed Cloud Edge, or the Operator Edge. And this is available in preview. It's a fully managed product that brings Google Cloud's infrastructure and services closer to where your data is being generated and consumed. And Google Distributed Cloud Edge empowers you to run on 5G core and radio access networks with functions at the edge, alongside enterprise applications to support mission-critical use cases such as computer vision and Google AI Edge inference. Google Distributed Cloud Edge is ideal for running local data processing, low latency edge computing workloads, and this further enables a strategic partnership with Ericsson, Nokia, and NVIDIA, which I didn't mention here. You also can have a GPU at the edge option as well through NVIDIA's cloud. It's part of the service as well through Distributed Cloud Edge. So that's more like the wavelength thing. So this one I kind of get. I sort of understand why this isn't its own product. It's sort of interesting to me, and that they just dumped it into this distributed cloud thing, but this makes sense that they would have this.
I kind of think everything is going to be moving to the edge. I mean, the edge is just a small data center right now, ancillary to the main data centers, but everything will be moved to the edge. Why not?
I mean, it'll take time, but you know, I do think more and more will move to the edge. But they'll be just cost prohibitive and space prohibitiveness that, you know, there's a reason why they build data centers in the middle of nowhere near a hydroelectric dam.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I think the biggest holdback of the edge is really getting the right software development tools to make it easy to write those apps, because I think it's still hard. I think it's early days still for that. But I think as you know, some new tooling and platform capabilities come out to be out there, I think they'll be easier to do. And so then the final part of this is the Google Distributed Cloud hosted builds on their, which helps you get digital sovereignty, supporting both public sector and commercial entities that have strict data residency or security and privacy requirements. And the Google Distributed Cloud Hosted provides you with a safe and secure way to modernize your on-premise deployment, regardless of whether you do it yourself or choose to host through a designated trusted partner. The Google Distributed Hosted Cloud does not require connecting to Google Cloud at any time to manage infrastructure, services, APIs, or tooling, and uses a local control plane provided by Anthos for operations. And this is available to you in preview in the first half of 2022. This particularly helps for the cloud on Europe's terms, which is an initiative that France and Germany have come out with, saying basically they want the data in their thing. And so, of course, there's a partnership with Thales on the Google Distributed Cloud, and with two partnerships, including T-Systems in Germany and OVH Cloud in France. For those playing at home, OVH Cloud is the one that caught on fire, but that's nothing to be worried about. And so you can now run Google Cloud in a partner and buy it from the partner directly, which is an interesting play as well, very similar to the early vSphere cloud services that we used to see back in the day. vCloud.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. I hesitate, but I think I like it, you know, but it's one of those things, like it's the best way to keep that data where the data needs to go. And I like the increased privacy. And then what do, you know, companies like T-Systems and OVH Cloud, like, you know, they keep seeing probably, you know, a ton of service erosion as all these hyperscalers eat their business up. And so you know, this is what we've always said, right? All the data centers are eventually just going to go to the hyperscalers. This is what it looks like.
Yeah, it's interesting way to go. So that was probably the biggest announcement, I'd say, from Google Cloud Next today. I would not have predicted this in a prediction show, so I'm so glad that we did not do that. I maybe would have said something to compete with Wavelengths. I might have said something, but it wouldn't have been on my picks. It would have been.
I totally would have called that registry thing and then not gotten a point.
Oh, for the repos?
Does Google Cloud have a region in China yet?
I don't know.
I kind of wonder, like, I mean, just the framing of the building here. I mean, I know that they're mentioning Europe in the press release, but it would also let them have a partner in China for Chinese customers using the same framework if they don't already.
I mean, Google employees have not been very big fans of the China thing. You know, they had opened an office there for a while. They had started building at Google China, and then that kind of killed, and they shut it down. So right now, it does not offer, has not offered cloud platform services inside China. But you're right. This is something Alibaba could come in and buy, you know, use this service through Google, you know, as a partner of Google's, and offer that to customers who want it. So yeah, that's interesting. Back Trojan horse.
I don't think that's the way that would shake out.
How much they're going to charge?
Because the Chinese government's involvement in most things, like, they're not going to, oh yeah, no, let's just let this US company now.
Well, and even, you know, to be able to use Alibaba to do it, right, they would need to have some type of backdoors on things of Google. But again, it's open source. So then I guess maybe they could write that stuff they want into the open source and just not commit it back.
Yeah. Ugh.
Okay, now I don't...
Is it all going to be open source?
Now I don't like any of this. This is terrible.
Or at least has the potential to be terrible. You know, it'd be interesting to see if it changes sort of how people operate their own smaller data centers and see if it more is more of a democratization there. But yeah,
I don't.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see if certain data center companies get big on this as a partnership, but you know, you didn't see them run to the V cloud stuff, you know, other than Verizon, which didn't work out so well for them. So, you know, I don't know. We'll see.
Hey everyone, Jonathan here. I just wanted to take a minute to thank the cloud consulting gurus at Foghorn for helping make the Cloud Pod possible. These folks truly get it. Cloud consulting experts since 2008. They are premier tier partners with AWS, Google Cloud Platform Silver, and Microsoft Azure partners. From multi-cloud to containers to moving full production workloads to the cloud under the tightest compliance, Foghorn's team of full-stack cloud engineers have been there, done that, gotten the t-shirt, and are ready to share their experience with you. If you're in the market for some talent to supplement your team, visit www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. Foghorn, the promise of cloud delivered.
All right. Well, next up is Google Cloud is expanding their contact center AI and their contract doc AI capabilities. And this is all about moving up the stack for AI. So Google acknowledges that AI is very complicated and very difficult for many companies to take advantage of. And so by moving up the stack and giving you built-in, out-of-the-box solutions, you can enable AI-enabled outcomes without the big investments. So Contact Center AI Insights, which is now generally available, provides out-of-the-box and custom modeling techniques to make it easier for contact center teams to better understand customer interaction data. And the Contract Doc AI, now in preview, adds to Google Cloud's Document AI solution, a scalable cloud-based AI platform to help businesses efficiently scan, analyze, and understand documents. The Contract Doc AI brings new features purpose-built for the most important and complicated documents of all, which are contracts, allowing users to extract insights from unstructured text and contracts, helping to accelerate contract life cycles and reduce the cost of contract processing. Which, you know, having been in companies where, you know, you have a standard contract and then you have deviations for contracts, and how do you find those deviations after, you know, 5 years, it's like, oh, it's a nightmare. You have to hire somebody to go through those contracts. If you can use this service to solve that problem, that's huge. So I'm super glad to see something like that. They talk about some of their customers using this, including Mr. Cooper, which is a mortgage processing company and happens to be my mortgage holder. And they apparently have increased efficiency of mortgage document options by 400% using AI in their doc processing at Mr. Cooper. So lots of really interesting use cases on this. They were very excited to tout all the amazing stuff they're doing in doc AI. And document contract AI.
As long as like the main front door of the service is something where I can feed it a document and it just spits out like a, I don't know, maybe 3-sentence summary of how I'm going to get screwed by whatever company's trying to make me sign this contract. Like that's all I need.
Nice.
Did you notice the carve out?
Cool.
Did you notice the indemnity carve out?
It'd be cool though if you could start doing comparisons. Like, here's my standard contract. Tell me any differences between the standard and this contract. Like, there's some really cool enablement that you could do with this feature.
I'm pretty distrustful though. I see these stories where, you know, AI suddenly makes these leaps and can do these wonderful suggestions. And it reminds me of the Gimlet podcast about the digital assistant Sandra. I don't know if anyone's.
I have listened to that.
Yeah. Kind of wonder if this AI service is all actually powered by a data center full of people instead of technology. But if you haven't listened to it, it's worth checking out.
Yes, it is pretty good. But yeah, and I've been very familiar with certain companies' AI solutions and ML solutions that are very much built on top of people in India or in other third world countries. So
yeah, any intelligence that we can add to the contact center experience will be great.
All right. Well, next up is intelligent product essentials. And this is really targeted at the manufacturing space. So expectations for consumer and commercial products have changed, and consumers want products that evolve with their needs, adapt to their preferences, and stay up to date over time, as long as it's not a robot that takes over the world. Manufacturers, in turn, need to create products that provide engaging customer experiences, not only to better compete in the marketplace, but also provide new monetization opportunities. However, embedding intelligence into new and existing products is challenging, and from updating hardware to how to manage existing connected products that can't add new features, and combined with the lack of consumer telemetry and the lack of AI expertise to develop and deploy these features. And this is why Google is launching Intelligent Product Essentials, a terrible name, a solution that allows manufacturers to rapidly deliver products that adapt to their owners, update features over the air using AI at the edge, and provide customer insights using analytics in the cloud. It provides three capabilities for manufacturers. First, the ability to personalize the customer experience, providing a compelling ownership experience that evolves over the lifetime of the product. For example, a chatbot that contextualizes responses based on product status and customer profile. Manage and update products over the air, so you can deploy your updates, gather your insights, and evolve capabilities over time. And then predict parts and service issues, including detecting operating thresholds and anomalies, and predict failures. Rapidly recommend services using AI, reducing warranty claims, decreasing part shortages, and increasing customer satisfaction. And to enable all of this, it combines the edge connections via the IoT core and PubSub, as well as ML modes with Vertex AI at the edge. New ownership app templates to easily build connected product companion apps that work on smartphones, tablets, and computers. Product fleet management and AI service to create new features and capabilities, all embedded into the intelligent product essentials. Which tells you this is a lot of just wrapping up a bunch of products into a higher value service.
Yeah, we want to sell you all of these things, so we're just going to give it a new name.
Well, and we're going to be an easy button to take advantage of them, so then we can charge you a lot of money on the cloud service.
I do think it's like when you think about, you know, this is the robot that's going to take over the world. No. It's the contracts AI that we just talked about. They're going to beat us with lawyering. That's how they're going to take over the world. That's how Skynet defeats humanity. Yeah.
It kind of seems like they're productizing the stack they use to manage their own devices already, like Chromecast and Google Homes and all those things. This is exactly what they do already and very successfully. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense that the manufacturers would have approached them and said, hey, you know, can you help us out with this? Because you've already built it.
Yeah. And this is definitely things that, you know, Azure has with their IoT capabilities, and so does AWS. So simplifying this was a hole in their market. And so they now solve that hole by kind of putting these together. So,
I mean, AWS is basically this, but for infrastructure management for the Amazon.com retail store. So why wouldn't you take your existing IoT management if you've been very successful there and sell that as a product. It makes perfect sense.
Yep. So then TK passes back over to Sunil, who talked about the $10 billion investment in advancing the security of governments around the world and by extension help enterprises and organizations to do the same, which was a weird way of putting it. But hey, that's a press release.
Is that like protection money to the mob, or is that actually like an investment in technology?
It'd be a shame if something was to happen.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And so then they go on to talk about how they're delivering on their vision of invisible security, where capabilities are continuously engineered into both their trusted cloud platform and market-leading products, bring the best of Google Cloud security wherever your IT assets are. And so they've announced a ton of things this week. First up is the Google Cybersecurity Action Team, which marshals experts from across Google to form what they believe will be the world's premier security advisory team with a singular mission to support the security and digital transformation of governments, critical infrastructure, enterprises, and small business. Building on top of the security solution engineering efforts today, the Google Cybersecurity Action Team announced a security and resilience framework that delivers a roadmap of comprehensive security management aligned with NIST cybersecurity framework using Google Cloud technology and partners. So perfect. It's the action team of experts tell you how to do it with Google, and anything else is not going to work.
If TK and Sunil didn't take this opportunity to on stage, you know, do the back-to-back finger gun pose, you know, for the action team, it was a missed opportunity.
Yeah, they were not mm-hmm. close enough together in the video for that to happen. But yeah. All I could think of was the A-team and Pity the Fool who wants to mess with security when I saw this name. Clearly, they've hired away someone from marketing at AWS who helped them with the naming of this product, because it was like, wow, that's an interesting choice. So continuing on the security bend, they announced the Google Work Safer offering to help organizations, their employees, and partners collaborate and communicate securely and privately in today's hybrid work environment, which I assumed was a communication thing, which it was not. Work Safer provides companies with best-in-class security for email, meetings, messages, documents, and more, bringing together cloud-native zero-trust solutions of Google Workspace, which is what they now call Google Apps, with BeyondCorp Enterprise for secure access with integrated threat and data protection. And for secure devices, WorkSafer includes Pixel phones managed with Android Enterprise, Chrome Enterprise Upgrade, and HP Chromebooks, as well as leverage Google's Titan security keys for account protection, Recaptcha Enterprise for website fraud, and Chronicle for security analytics and a variety of migration services, all in the Google WorkSafer program.
So while I like this, I am struggling to keep up with the name changes from Google Apps to Google Workspace, and then I think I know what BeyondCorp is, but I, you know, I thought it was just a different version of these apps or like an integration. Maybe I don't.
Well, BeyondCorp is just their reference architecture for what they do for zero trust security.
Is that all it is? There's no product to it? I thought there was a thing you could.
No, no product.
Well, they have kind of a BeyondCorp Enterprise thing, which I don't think is actually a product. Well, yeah, we'll keep going through the list of things and maybe we'll figure this out. So next up is the Trusted Cloud Enhancements. Which Protect employs the new Zero Trust access capabilities with BeyondTrust Enterprise, making it easier for admins to diagnose access failure, triage events, and unblock users with a new policy troubleshooter. Which all I think about when I hear this is, oh, it's group policy troubleshooting because it's going to break in terrible ways that you're not going to know how to deal with. They're also improving your detection and response with their new collaboration with CyberReason for extended detection and response, or XDR, across endpoints, networks, cloud, and workspaces, and deeply integrated into Chronicle and Security Command Center. A new automatic DLP, now in preview, is a great way of making invisible security a reality with a game-changing capability that discovers classified sensitive data for all BigQuery projects across the entire organization. And then the ubiquitous data encryption, a solution which combines the general availability of confidential computing, external key management, and cloud storage products to seamlessly encrypt data that's sent to the cloud. You guys are wild on this one. I can see it on your faces.
So, well, I'm still stuck on like, you know, just my personal sort of experience with some of these tools that they're partnering with. And so it's just like, yeah, I mean, this is all great. I guess maybe this is a reference implementation that would make it not so that I couldn't do my job. But, you know, like right now, like it doesn't feel that way for me. So,
yeah,
it gets us closer to a zero trust. I'm really looking forward to a world where we could run on zero trust networks in general.
Networks I like.
That'd be so much
networks
easier.
Networks I get, but you know, once you start basically removing permissions at the end workstation level to do things and trying to manage that globally or centrally, it can make us very tricky.
Well, and it gets expensive because, you know, today what you're building and how you're defining it is one thing, but then, you know, you say, oh, well, we want to use the new language from, you know, some other company, like Ruby. I want to go back to Ruby for some reason. You know, and you don't have any of the pipeline, or even like now you also have a bunch of IT tickets because you don't have any of the Ruby pipeline stuff installed on your laptop, and now you're doing a lot of work. And so, you know, in a polyglot engineering organization, which is a lot of these companies are going to, you know, how do you define this boundary that these things are supposed to live inside of? So I do see that as kind of the challenge, which is why these tools that let you troubleshoot these policies is helpful. But yeah, it does feel a little weird, which is why you have your own personal laptop.
That's true. Not, yeah.
Yep. Only a corporate one. So next up is Zero Trust Software Supply Chain. With Cloud Build is now SLSA level 1 compliant. I don't know what this is. I've never looked up SLSA, but apparently it's a thing. With scripted builds and availability provenance. With the new build integrity feature, Cloud Build automatically generates verifiable build manifests that include a signed certificate describing the sources that went into the build, the hashes of the artifacts used, and other parameters. And of course, this can all be fed into binary authorization to run on the trusted cloud compute. So this integration is super critical.
Yeah, I mean, this is another sort of, you know, like the registry or the repository product, you know, supply chain is becoming, securing your supply chain is just becoming a very important thing that you have to do. So it's cool.
Yep.
Increase the cost and effort of being a cyber criminal. They're, even if they're boring announcements, it's all so great. Every one of them incrementally makes it
a little harder.
Makes it less profitable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Take that company that has agents that get compromised in the supply chain and then infiltrate agencies all over the world.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's spawned this whole industry for supply chain protection, just that one breach. So.
Yeah. And then, of course, because you've protected all your end users and all your people inside, you now need to protect your website. So Cloud Armor Bot Management is now integrated with Cloud Armor, which is their DDoS service, and Recaptcha Enterprise, easily enabling protection without any server-side changes to your applications. And because detection and enforcement happen in line at the edge of Google's network, you can mitigate threats before they have a chance to impact your applications, whether they run on GCP, on-prem, or in a hybrid multi-cloud deployment, which this is really nice. You know, anything you do to make Recaptcha easier to integrate those things is super helpful. So this is a good one. And then, of course, it couldn't be a Google conference without something to mess with collaboration features. So Secure Collaboration is here, which Google Workspace is introducing new security features, including client-side encryption for Google Meet in beta, which gives customers direct control over encryption keys and identity services using access keys, as well as a new DLP for Google Chat, which helps prevent sensitive information from leaking outside of the org. Which, depending on how that DLP is implemented, it could be cool or it could be really a big pain in the butt. Because I know when you know, some of the other DLP solutions got added on, you try to attach a document and all of a sudden it would pop up and say, why are you taking this, you know, company IP and putting it, it's not company IP, it's a contract from a vendor that I'm sending to our legal team, but you're yelling at me anyways. Just terrible things that could happen with DLP. But depending on how it's interacted, you know, how it interfaces and how it addresses that, as long as it has good feedback mechanisms, I'm okay with it in theory.
It really is. I mean, that's the important part about all these security tools, is that in order to roll them out, the tools have the functionality built in, but unless you're offering that as a service to your end users, like we're using this tool to protect our end users as a service, and thinking about the holistic, you know, management of the settings, the deployment, and the full life cycle of those things. Like it's the difference between enabling your business to be secure and just shooting it in the foot. Super important.
For listeners of the Cloud Pod, you know that I have no love for Microsoft Active Directory, which is why I'm excited to tell you about the leading cloud directory platform, JumpCloud. JumpCloud makes it easy to solve today's IT challenges by unifying device and user management through a single pane of glass, enabling you to securely manage your users and devices and perform common tasks like onboarding and offboarding remote workers. With JumpCloud, you no longer need to implement an on-premise Active Directory infrastructure or additional tooling to scope a user's access, and you can ensure that the user is coming from trusted devices and networks. Enabling JumpCloud's zero-trust solutions improves the security and compliance of your network, ensuring users have access only to the services they need when they need them. To start your organization's move to a modern, secure hybrid work model, try JumpCloud for free today at cloud.jumpcloud.com/thecloudpod. That's cloud.jumpcloud.com/thecloudpod. So then that was the security space. So lots of good security tools, lots of good security things. Again, I don't know that I would pick any of those for a prediction show. So glad I missed that. But this next thing I definitely would not have talked about in my any prediction, which is that Google is following in Azure's footsteps and giving you several tools to help manage your environmental impact. First up is Carbon Footprint, a new product. I mean, look at the naming. Carbon Footprint. I know exactly what it does. A new product that provides customers with the gross carbon emissions associated with their Google Cloud platform usage, available to every GCP user for free in the Google Cloud console. This tool helps you measure, track, and report on the gross carbon emissions associated with electricity of your cloud usage. Google reminds you, though, that even though we're telling you the gross, it doesn't matter because the net operational emissions of Google Cloud is zero and will still be zero. So it's really kind of just so you feel warm and fuzzy about your gross.
Completely pointless. Yeah.
You know what? Since the Azure announcement, I figured out what the point of this is. This is so that you can claim this for your own carbon neutrality if you're dealing in the business of carbon credits. So I'm sure that they're using this for accounting so that you can offset in other areas or use this.
Is that a thing in other countries? Because I know in U.S. we never pass cap and trade or any of the, you know, zero carbon emission requirements to businesses. So is that somewhere in the world? Is that a thing? Or are people worried about that?
I assume so, just because I'm seeing a lot of products like this. I don't know the specifics per country, but you know, I think if it's not specifically legally mandated, it's at least a way to sort of demonstrate your part in the environment, and your companies use that for sales.
Makes sense. They're also partnering with Salesforce Sustainability Cloud, so you can not only measure the cloud impact of your GCP stuff, but also your SaaS apps running through Salesforce Sustainability Cloud to determine the larger footprint of your carbon across your enterprise. The Active Assist Recommender, which typically gives you recommendations based on cost, performance, security, and manageability, will now give you sustainability recommendations. Starting with the Unattended Project Recommender, which we'll talk about a few episodes ago, you'll soon be able to estimate the gross carbon emissions you'll save by removing your idle resources. And for customers who face difficult questions about how their business impacts the natural environment today and how it's affected by climate change in the future, they're integrating BigQuery with Google Earth Engine, which has supported scientists and developers the world's largest catalog of satellite image data. So you can now overlay all of your carbon data on top of Google Earth, which is pretty cool. That's a nice feature.
Oh, wow. So like bit mining operations can report on how many Amazons per hour they're... they're destroying or whatever. how many trees per hour?
Well, you know, if charging you a lot of money wasn't gonna, you know, get you to turn off those things, maybe if we show you like a heat map of how much carbon you're generating, will.
Then Google, you know, now gave us some other just kind of like what's new at Next. And so there's some things I missed they kind of highlighted. So Google Cloud Cortex Framework is a new foundation of endorsed solution reference templates for content for customers to accelerate business outcomes with risk. It's an SAP thing. That's all I can say. Vertex AI Workbench is a natural evolution of Google Cloud's notebooks offering, which responds to the ever-changing needs of our customers for standardized integrated ML tooling. Hopefully that's more secure than Azure's notebooks. And a new partner advantage program for new data center transformation specialization scheduled for Q1 22. So Foghorn can go become a data center transformation specialist for Google Cloud.
Yes.
Always good. Of course, there was no code, not on the main stage that I saw, but as part of the Workspaces, they're now going to be rolling out AppSheet. It's no-code app and automation development platform. We're coming out to email inboxes everywhere. So that's unfortunate. And then the Trello integration with Google Chat, since Trello is owned by Atlassian, is now being expanded to support Jira. So you'll be able to do all of your Google Chat Jira things now natively as well. And then Looker and Tableau are being integrated more seamlessly. So you can now use Tableau to access your Looker tables and Looker data sets. That was day one, guys. Yeah. That was a lot.
You know, I actually watched the first three movies of the Twilight series over the past few days to try and prepare myself for the tedium that was going to be these announcements.
And did it help? Or? No,
I think watching Breaking Dawn episode 1 and 2probably would have numbed me sufficiently for the second day. Carry on.
All right. So then on day two, they had a developer-centric keynote. And so there's a bunch of developer things where they highlighted. First up is that if you want to use Cloud Spanner, but you don't know Cloud Spanner APIs and you have Postgres, you can now do that with the Postgres interface for Cloud Spanner, now in preview. The interface supports several popular Postgres SQL data types and SQL features, allowing schemas and queries to be built against the Postgres SQL interface to be ported to another Postgres environment to avoid that sweet, sweet lock-in if you want. But I don't know how full and feature complete that's going to be. So do test that, because I imagine still stored procedures and other things that you're used to in Postgres may not work in Cloud Spanner just based on the architecture of Cloud Spanner. But to be able to at least use some basic PSQL commands, I'm sure is a good roadmap for many developers to that platform.
Preview.
It's a weird thing about avoiding lock-in by actually reducing the feature set you're prepared to use as part of your app stack, though.
I mean, that's sort of always been the way to avoid lock-in of databases to begin with.
Exactly.
Stay away from store procedures, stay away from triggers, stay away from the fancy stuff. Just use it as a data store. And then you avoid lock-in of SQL Server or Postgres or Oracle or whatever else. So no one ever did that, of course, which is why then you end up with terrible store procedures and triggers everywhere. But that's nice. A cloud built for developers was the topic of the morning keynote as well. And they point out all the amazing things they're doing to make developers' lives easier, including the TAL VMs, delivering innovations in data, AI, and security with every feature they want to be easier for developers. They highlighted GKE Autopilot, and they spent a lot of time on the Google Shell Editor, a context-aware remote development environment you can develop and manage applications securely from any browser with nothing to download or install locally. It comes with an integrated debugger, source control, API Explorer, and if you want to test locally, on your laptop has local emulators for Kubernetes and serverless APIs, which, you know, hey, Amazon, will you please take a note on that? Like, people want to test locally on their laptops, even if it's dummy APIs. It's now easier than ever to deploy with Cloud Build, Cloud Run, and Cloud Deploy and binary authorization. And it's easy to extend your application with Cloud Functions and easy to operate with Google Cloud's Operation Suite, making it easy to monitor, troubleshoot, and improve application performance and production with one integrated view of alerts, events, metrics, and logs. You don't have to jump between multiple tools while you're troubleshooting issues. And of course, they're highlighting all the amazing Google Cloud innovators are a huge part of this, and Google's committed to enabling developers, highlighting champions, et cetera. And so they're announcing the Innovators Program, which you can now join today, kind of like the AWS program, but just for Google Cloud. So there you go. And then if you're really confused about Anthos and you're really confused about the data center thing,
and you have a lot of money,
we can confuse you even, and you have a lot of money. They are excited to also now enable the Anthos for virtual machines, now in preview, allowing you to standardize on Kubernetes while continuing to run some workloads that cannot easily be containerized in virtual machines. Anthos for VMs will help platform developers standardize on an operation model, process and tooling, incremental modernization efforts, and support traditional workloads via virtual network functions or stateful monolithic workloads. Take advantage of this in two ways, either by attaching your vSphere VM to Anthos or shifting your VMs as is with the KubeVirt virtualization capability. If interested, Google has released a fit assessment tool to identify which approach to take and can help you do this right away to get you onto the Google Cloud with VMs.
So if I connect VMware's Tanzu and combine it with Google's Anthos, I can just basically have it manage itself, right? Yeah.
Yeah, sure. And you know, one of the benefits is it'll be consistently secure and the policies will be the same, and you'll gain visibility to the health and performance of all those things that you just mentioned. Because making that work in your observability platform is going to be difficult regardless of what you do. And that is it through Google Cloud Next, at least through this morning. I imagine there may be a couple more things come out there later in the week. We'll talk about those next week here on the show. There you go. That was Google Cloud Next. I'm glad we didn't do predictions once again. I would have lost horribly. I think all of you would have lost too.
Yeah, I never win.
And for day two, Jonathan's going to go join one of those monasteries where they practice self-flagellation because, you know, Twilight.
I mean, Google Cloud Next didn't have to happen for that to
occur. It's true.
Just watching the Twilight movies would have resulted in that outcome.
And what scares me is by the third movie, I was actually quite enjoying it.
Are you team Jacob or team, what's the other one's name? I don't know.
Edward.
Edward,
totally team Jacob.
Interesting. I think everyone's team Jacob. How many people are actually team Edward?
I've never heard of one, to be honest.
Well, yeah. Edward was the vampire and Jacob was
werewolf?
Werewolf, yeah. I now reach the end of my knowledge on the Twilight series. Other than Kristen Stewart star in the movies, which I, you know, almost ruined her career. So she's coming back now, though. Coming back strong.
Yeah, she's grown up and
more than I know about it. That's for sure.
Peter's just sitting out there. He knows all about it. He's just not saying it. He doesn't want to ruin his credibility.
Yeah, he's read every book. He's moderating the Reddit forum.
You guys can't see it because it's on a camera, but he's literally got a Rob Pattinson poster up in the background of his bedroom.
Yes, I do. Big fan, big
and his,
fan.
And his skin kind of sparkles just like Robert Pattinson does. Yeah.
I wear sunscreen all the time.
Nice. All right, let's move on to Azure, who also was very quiet this week. Again, being nice to Google to let them have their time in the sun. First up is Windows 11 is now generally available on Azure Virtual Desktop, which, of course, because they wrote it, I would hope that they would support it. Azure Virtual Desktop still provides exclusive support for multi-session, an important option that helps you optimize costs by running multiple users on a single Azure VM. So I can yell at Jonathan directly when he's taking all my CPU. Trusted Launch and Preview enables TPM 2.0 and Secure Boot as part of your VM configuration to take full advantage of the security capabilities of Windows 11. And some higher-end graphics effects such as transparencies, animations, and rounded corners may be required using the Azure Virtual Desktop with Azure VM with the right GPU, which you can't do rounded corners without a GPU. Come on, Microsoft. Get started today with three options, including Windows 11 Enterprise, Windows 11 Enterprise Multi-Session, and Multi-Session plus Microsoft 365 apps. I did update my computer home to Windows 11, and I don't hate it, and I don't love it. That's the most neutral review I can give of it. So there's some things that polish. A little
prettier, maybe?
It looks a little prettier. They unified some of the UI mistakes they made. They revamped the control panel, which was desperately needed. And they revamped some of the start bar. And then they took the start menu, and instead of being left justified, it's now centered, just like the Apple is.
Oh.
So that's probably the hardest part to get used to, is where that start button is. But other than that, it's relatively the same thing. I don't really notice.
For a Windows major release, that is high praise. Like, I don't remember a single release where it's like, I hate this thing.
Nor do I love it. Yeah.
I remember Windows 8.
It is definitely not a Windows 8. Yeah,
it's
not a Windows
8.
Or a Windows Me. It's not one of those.
Windows 8 made me buy a Mac.
Yeah. I think that's what I bought one too, actually.
Speaking of buying a Mac, I'm going to be spending $1 million next week because I hear the MacBooks are coming next week. Super excited. Mm-hmm.
Next week.
Oh, I'm going to do the same thing.
ARM 16-inch MacBooks.
Can you send me send me your specs so I don't have to do anything. All
right. Well, I'll let you know what those are going to be once they announce it on Monday. So. All right. And then Azure in August told us about how amazing they've been doing with DDoS attacks and how they'd actually seen a reduction in the attacks, 25% increase over Q4 2020, but with a decline in the maximum throughput of 1 terabyte per second to only 625 megabits per second in the first half of 2021. However, after they posted this, in the last week of August, maybe don't brag next time, they observed a 2.4 terabits per second DDoS attack targeting an Azure customer in Europe. This is 140% higher than the 2020 terabyte attack and higher than any network volumetric event previously detected on Azure. Attack came from over 70,000 sources from multiple countries in the APAC region, including Malaysia, Vietnam, Taiwan, Japan, and China, as well as the United States. The attack vector was a UDP reflection spanning more than 10 minutes with a very short-lived burst. each ramping up in seconds to terabit volumes. And they measured three peaks, and the first at 2.4, the second at 0.55 terabits per second, and the third at 1.7 terabits per second. So great that you survived that. I'm super happy about that, but maybe not be so braggy. That's all I can say.
Well, you say survive, but the press release says business as usual. I mean, you're making a great leap that actually business as usual is pretty good.
Ooh.
Ooh. Wow. Especially after they had an 8-hour outage yesterday that no one knew about. Maybe not so great there, but there we go. I think maybe Azure customers are just used to downtime because of Windows in general. So like 8 hours, that's nothing. You know, I had to exchange outages back in the day that took whole days to get email back.
I mean, there's reboots that take that long, right?
Yeah, installing system updates.
Yeah, which why that's still a blocking operation at boot time blows my mind. But anyways, well, that is it for this week's Cloud Pod, other than lightning round. And I'll turn it over to Peter, who's twinkling in anticipation.
Hey, AWS CloudFormation customers can now manage their applications in AWS Systems Manager.
Making you want all of those deviation alerts available to you, because as you mess up your application from the app with CloudFormation, that's never a good thing.
I'm still struggling to figure out how you're going to create all those, you know, system manager fleets and patch management in CloudFormation.
That's true. That's very true.
AWS Network Firewall adds new configuration options for rule ordering and default drop.
Such a basic feature. I'd like to reorder my rules. Sorry, you have to delete them and re-add them in the order you want. Thank you for this. Can you please add this for the WAF? Because the WAF also has this problem. You cannot reorder rules on the WAF. Please, Amazon, bring that there.
One rule to rule them all. It's all you need. Just default drop.
Yep. Drop it like it's up.
There you go. Amazon QuickSight adds support for pixel perfect dashboards.
I mean, someone out there is so persnickety that they want those things lined up pixel perfect every time with QuickSight, and they're not using Tableau. Why?
Well, because they don't know the hygiene of the data set for sure. It'll look pretty, but it's not accurate.
Yeah.
Well, that's the case of Tableau too. Garbage in, garbage out. Just pixel perfect garbage.
Amazon ECS Anywhere now supports GPU-based workloads.
I mean, clearly you just want to burn money through your pockets all day long. Only way to make this more expensive is to use EKS. But
we'll start with ECS. You've already burned all the money by buying all those GPUs, which are, you know, in short supply and very expensive. You may as well, you know, get some use out of them.
Sure.
For sure. Now, this one, probably no one but me is going to be interested in. AWS Marketplace now supports viewing agreements and canceling and extending offers for professional services, which means I can make an offer to a company for a ProServe statement of work, and then they can buy it through the marketplace and pay on their AWS bill. I could lose 2% on it.
Yep. The only reason why this is important is for those customers using Accenture to cancel their agreement with Accenture and move it to Foghorn. That's the only reason why this is good.
Yes. Cancel those agreements. Move to Foghorn.
Fog ops for the win.
I just realized why, you know, Peter's such a Twilight fan is because his day job is viewing these agreements, canceling, extending them, and coordinating all these things. So he's trying to make himself numb as well.
Yeah, relative to that, movies are quite exciting. Amazon Open Search Service, which is the successor to the Amazon Elasticsearch Service, now comes with an improved management console.
Which is very similar to the Windows 11 update. Just a new wrapper. Nothing special. Yeah. By the way, all of the Amazon OpenSearch services now include that successor to Amazon Elasticsearch service, Peter. So you will get to say that a lot. So do practice that at home, because all the lightning round stories on OpenSearch service will have the successor to Amazon Elasticsearch service. So you're welcome. Thanks.
Awesome. Love it.
Now if we can get Elasticsearch with MongoDB compatibility, we'll be in good shape.
Yep, there you go.
Can we change it to formerly known as... The service formerly known as Amazon.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Yes.
GA announcement, now generally available Azure Service Tag Discovery API.
Just imagine having botched tagging implementation so badly that you had to write our own API just to do discovery of tags. Oh, come on, Peter. Get your shit together.
I'm not going to throw stones from my glass house.
Like, I think everything. Oops.
And one more GA, Azure Monitor Container Insights Portal Experience Update is now generally available.
So all those people using AKS, which is, I know, dozens of you out there, can now monitor your container insights.
And I feel like that was just seven random words put in order.
The insight is the app still doesn't work and I still don't know why.
But now you can use Google Cloud Insights or the Google Cloud Data Center thing to now do all your stuff in Azure. So just move to that. Anthos for the win. Distributed cloud.
And that is the end of our lightning round. Ryan, I think you might have won that straight up, but I was going to give it to you anyway because I don't like the shenanigans that happened last week. So Ryan gets the win. But I think you actually earned it on that. I think you actually earned it today. It was good.
Yeah. Well, how did he earn it though? Is it, which one was it?
He was very talkative.
He was more so than
massaging his beard while he was talking. And
it's become a new habit of mine is the evil empire stroke. Yeah.
It's a very Moriarty look to him. Yeah.
I really liked the one rule to rule them all. To drop them all. One rule to drop
them all. That's fair. I'll take that one. I forgot about it because there were so many other good ones that came after that.
Nice.
By me. Plus, I can't give it to sucking up the foghorn on the AWS Marketplace one. I can't.
I mean, you make the rules. Like you can do whatever you want. I'm just saying. All right. Well, things are coming up again here in the cloud. Of course, Google Cloud Next is past us. Well, almost past us. At least it's not in 12 weeks of Google Cloud Next. Thank goodness. But there are a few more weeks of it. So we will talk about it, I'm sure, several more times over the next few weeks. But HashiConf, this is the last chance. We'll not ship this before that comes out. So when this comes out, you could join HashiConf right that minute. But otherwise, you're going to miss it. The Google Government and Education Summit is November 3rd through the 4th. And then Microsoft Ignite, November 2nd through the 4th, to learn all about Azure DDoS. Check that out. And then reInvent, coming up strong, November 29th through December 3rd in Las Vegas. Still not canceled. Check today. I did. You do have to pre-register for your classes and get into those as those are going on reservation, I think, on Friday this week. So too late for you if you're listening to the show now. But for those of you who are hosts on the show who are going to reInvent, do that before Friday. Yeah. So you're ready to go.
Try.
And that is it for this week in the Cloud Pod. Have a good week. See you next. Well, we won't see Jonathan and Ryan next week because but we'll have some special guests for everybody. It'll be Peter and I and two guests. So look forward to that next week here on the show.
Yeah.
Later, guys.
Perfect.
Good luck. Have fun. Night. See you.
Bye, everybody.
And that is the week in the cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsors, Foghorn Consulting and Jump Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, and send feedback or ask questions at thecloudpod.net or tweet us with the hashtag #thecloudpod.